Acts 18, we were in Athens. We spent several weeks in Athens. But just to remind us, as we are on Paul's second missionary journey. So his first missionary journey, he went from Antioch, he went down into Cyprus and went up into Perga, went up into this region here, and then went back over to Antioch. After that, he went down to Jerusalem, Acts chapter 15, for the Jerusalem Council, returned to Antioch, and then Acts chapter 16, he leaves Antioch and he goes back through this region here, takes a letter from the church in Jerusalem to Antioch and then up to these churches here, communicating to them, affirming the truths of the gospel that it is by grace alone and is not at all by keeping the law. He left this region and then ended up in Troas. And you may remember this is kind of a turning point in Paul's travels here. Why does he go to Troas and not, let's say, Ephesus or up towards the Black Sea? Why does he end up in Troas? Yeah, that's where the Holy Spirit directed him. He wanted to go into this region here of Asia, and the Holy Spirit forbade him. He ends up in Troas. There he has the Macedonian vision. A man of Macedonia calls them to come over, and so Paul and Luke and others with him, Timothy we know was with him as well as Silas. So you have Paul, Luke, Timothy, and Silas, and probably some others go from Troas up to Neapolis, to Philippi, to Thessalonica, and then to Berea. And what happened in Philippi, just broadly speaking, what are some memorable things that happened? Yeah, he was thrown in prison and the Philippian jailer was converted and Paul more or less fled the city. Not quite just in the middle of the night running away, but more or less fled the city. He went down to Thessalonica. Does anybody remember what happened there? There was actually a big riot in Thessalonica, and for the sake of the believers there, Paul left Thessalonica, somewhat fled, went to Berea. And the Jews that had been following him around and came down from Thessalonica, and so what happened? Yeah, he had to flee the city again. It does tell us that he took to the sea, he goes around down to Athens. And there we spent several weeks in Acts chapter 17 examining Paul's sermon there at Areopagus or Mars Hill. Doesn't indicate that he had to flee Athens. So it seems like for a moment anyway, he is no longer being harassed by the disagreeable Jews that have been following him around. And he goes now from Athens to the city of Corinth in Acts 18. And this is a significant stopping point in Paul's missionary journeys. It's significant to us in part because we have two biblical letters that were written to the church in Corinth. And they are very noteworthy letters because the church in Corinth was a mess. And it's also a very significant stop because Paul spends a year and a half in Corinth, which is rather remarkable when you go back to Thessalonica and he was there for no more than a few weeks. Probably something similar in Berea. And we don't know how long he is in Athens, though as we go through Acts 18, we're going to see from the timeline, he's probably there a few weeks, maybe a couple months. He's not there long. And as far as the biblical record goes, this is the longest that he has spent in a city up to this point in his missionary journeys. And so let's read verse 1 of Acts 18. Now after these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Well, let me stop there because there's a lot of names right there. So on the map, we actually have it here. This is Pontus. And Italy, you can only see just the heel of the boot. So Aquila was from there. He had gone over to Italy, probably was close to Rome itself. And why did they leave Italy? Why did Aquila and his wife Priscilla leave Italy? All right. Who was Claudius? Yeah, he was a Roman Caesar. He was the emperor of the Roman Empire. And that's an important little tidbit of information because we know when that happened. That happened in 49 AD. So the events of Acts 18:1, then had to take place when? Yeah, after 49 AD. So the earliest this could be is 49 AD. There's another marker that's going to tell us the latest that it could be. So this is sometime after 49 AD. It does tell us that they had recently come from Italy, so it's probably not 10 years after 49 AD. It's a little bit more recent than that. And so it tells us there at the end of verse 2 that Paul found this couple. He came to them. Verse 3, so because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. So what was Aquila and Priscilla's occupation? So what is a tent maker? Yeah, somebody who makes tents. I mean, it's really obvious. They would have worked in heavy fabrics, possibly leathers, making these tents that would have been used for a wide variety of things. And so Aquila and Priscilla were tent makers. By deduction, what was Paul's profession or occupation? He was a tent maker. How do we know that? Yeah, it says he was of the same trade. I know we're stating the obvious here, but again, remind us at times we need to note the obvious. Other times we overlook it. And this is how we know Paul was a tent maker, because it tells us he was of the same occupation as Aquila and Priscilla. While he was doing that, verse 4, what else did he do? Yeah, he taught in the synagogues, or it uses what word? He reasoned there. So there is a bit of a discussion, and if you will, debate back and forth, not necessarily argumentative, but the back and forth of ideas in the synagogue. And what was the result of his reasoning in the synagogues? Still in verse 4. Okay, he persuaded two groups of people, Jews and Greeks. And because this is in the synagogues, this tells us those Greeks would have been the God-fearers. They would have been there listening in the synagogues. They may have been donors to it. They were probably keeping kosher. They would have been observant of some of the Mosaic laws. They weren't fully in the synagogue. They weren't Jews. They probably were not circumcised and able to participate fully in the synagogue. And more than likely, they are, again, the God-fearers, those that are part of it, but they're kind of there, but they're not all the way in the inner circle. But the result of Paul's reasoning in the synagogue, well, what's another way we would describe their being persuaded? Yeah, they came to faith. They believed. So these ones were saved. And so we talk about him reasoning in the synagogue. We know from what Luke has already told us about Paul's ministry in the synagogues that he would have gone in and reasoned with them, showing them that Jesus is the Messiah. And so we could go back to Acts 13, for example, and we could see an example of what Paul probably would have been teaching and proving in the synagogue. And so verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. And so now it seems as if there's a shift. So if I'm understanding what Luke is saying correctly here, Paul goes into Corinth. He's ministering first in the synagogues and he's working during the week. When Silas and Timothy come, they begin now a much more public ministry. And that's the way that I understand this, is that he now begins to go out maybe into the marketplace a little bit more to be much more publicly preaching the gospel. Not that it was hidden before. I don't want to suggest that it was in any way limited, but that his ministry went to another level when they showed up. And so here, verse 6, how did the Jews respond? Yeah, really, like we have been seeing them respond throughout. What two specific words does it use to describe it? Yeah, so they opposed him and they blasphemed. And so they stand up in opposition to Paul's preaching. And the word blasphemed, it actually is the word slandered. And in every case, we see it in the New Testament, at least every case I know of, it is slandered. Now, when we're talking about slandering God, it's blasphemy, as we would think of it as a religious thing. When we're talking about slandering an individual, it's just slandering an individual. And so really the context here, it could be either, you know, blasphemy of God, defaming Jesus, or it could be slandering Paul. Both are very likely possibilities, and I honestly don't know how to decide which is which in this particular context. But the important thing is they opposed the preaching of the gospel. They utterly rejected it. And so Paul said, "Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshiped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. So he goes now, he takes up residence with Justus, who would have been a Greek or Gentile. In this case, probably would have been actually Grecian. At least it's very likely given where Paul is, since he's in the city of Corinth. And again, it is right next door to the synagogue. Verse 8, then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue. Let me stop before I read any more. Does anybody know what a ruler of the synagogue is? Yeah, that's exactly right as far as it goes. He was the one who was ordering the service, telling people who's reading what, determining what readings are being read today, determining which of the guests that may be in the audience would be allowed to speak that day. He absolutely was responsible for the order of service and all that involved with it. He also was responsible for just the general maintenance of the synagogue. So he was the overseer of the grounds, making sure everything was taken care of. The building was in good shape. Seats were in good shape. So he was really just in charge of it. The term sometimes is used is he was the president of the synagogue. He very much was an administrator of the synagogue. With that as well, he held a very high position in the Jewish community. Even today, the rabbis are respected leaders within the Jewish community. The head of the synagogue absolutely is one of the most respected members within the community. He would have had great influence among the Jews. He would have been a counselor. He would have given direction to them, answering their questions that they might have about the Old Testament, giving guidance in how they do and apply it to their lives and their circumstances. And so a lot in the job description is very similar to a typical job description of a pastor. There's a lot of differences. I'm not saying that they're identical at all, but there's certainly a lot of overlap. And it's also, again, if you're familiar at all with modern day synagogues, the ruler of synagogue today would still be doing many of the same things and have much the same importance and influence that a ruler of the synagogue had in that day. And so this was a incredibly important man within the Jewish community. And so Crispus, the ruler of that synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. And so this is quite noteworthy. How have rulers of the synagogues typically responded to the apostles and even to Jesus before that? Yeah, the rulers of the synagogue typically responded to the preaching of the gospel, to the apostles, to Jesus himself, with intense opposition. Wanted him gone or dead or both. This one believes, as well as many other Corinthians. And note the order here. I'm not going to do anything more than just point it out, but note the order. They heard, they believed, they were baptized. You know, that is the biblical order. As we talk about the gospel, we talk about the relationship of baptism to the gospel. You hear the gospel, believe the gospel. When you believe, then you are baptized. And then verse 9, now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city. This is unusual. The Lord really coming to Paul in this vision and just encouraging him. I mean, how would you summarize what God tells Paul in verses 9 and 10? I'm with you. And what else? Speak out. Don't be afraid. Speak up because I'm with you. Why would you think that's necessary? Paul has had to flee the city. He has faced intense persecution. Even in Athens, at least what's recorded in Athens, is some joined him and believed. And there's not much else that's said. And there are many, and I think there's an argument to say that Paul's ministry in Athens we might say was a failure. That's not the right word to use. Paul was faithful in preaching the gospel, and when we are faithful, we are not failures. But if we're measuring results, it seems as if the results in Athens were not very good. There weren't a lot. And so it's possible, you know, he's coming out of fleeing the last three cities before Athens, going to Athens, and maybe there's discouragement in Athens. And then he comes to Corinth, and God says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to speak. Don't keep silent. And he specifically says, no one will attack you to hurt you, because he has many people in this city. So verse 11, how long did Paul stay in Corinth? A year and 6 months. And then verse 12, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, Gallio would have been the Roman ruler, the Roman governor of this region. Again, I'll stop there. This Gallio gives us our latest possible date for these things to happen, as we have historical records of when Gallio came into office in Achaia, which was 51 AD. And so we now know that all of the events that are being described right here in Acts 18, they've taken place again in Corinth. And we know, because of the decree of Claudius and the proconsulship of Gallio, that it had to happen after 49 AD, before 51 AD. And that becomes really very helpful as we're thinking through what's going on in the book of Acts. As we go back to Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council, and there they raise and discuss the question of the Gentiles' obligation to the law. And the conclusion is that the gospel does not require keeping the law, but rather the law itself, as Peter said, is a burden which they nor their fathers could not bear. That the keeping of the law is an obligation not to be imposed upon the Gentiles. So because we know these things here happened after 49 AD, before 51 AD, because we also know that Paul has spent some months traveling, because remember, he has to get from Antioch to Corinth with stops along the way, and he's traveling on foot for the majority of it. And so there's months involved in this journey. That means the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15 could take place no later than early 49 AD. It is possible Paul is in Corinth late 49 AD because he's there a year and a half, and then all of this with Gallio seems to be somewhat towards the end, not at the very end, but somewhat towards the end of Paul's stay in Corinth. So maybe he was there late 49 AD. I think it much more likely he's there 50 AD. And so the Jerusalem Council, I think the best date is 49 AD, maybe 48 AD. So that puts Acts chapter 2, the beginning of the church, up to Acts chapter 15 in that period of time from, depending on where you date the crucifixion and the resurrection, 30, 33 AD to 49 AD. So you have everything happening. I put the crucifixion earlier. I think the 30 AD is the better date. But you have all of that which is happening in the first 15 chapters of Acts is less than 20 years in history. And we have other dates. If you remember, we've gone back through and we've seen other dates of when these things are likely to have happened. And so in one respect, we're talking about the beginning of a completely new movement, if you want to say a completely new religion, and is exploding in less than 20 years. So remember, as we're talking about Paul traveling and preaching the gospel, we're not just talking about him going into a city preaching and then having to run away. We know historically that there are churches all in this region of Galatia. We know there's a church started there during Paul's ministry. We know there's a thriving church in Antioch. We know that Derbe and Lystra, Iconium, Perga, Pisidia, all of these places have churches at this point in time. We know that there's a church in Philippi. How do I know there was a church in Philippi? Yeah, there was a little letter written to them. So there's a church here. There's a church in Thessalonica. And all of this is before Acts 18. And this is just the ministry of Paul. We talk about the ministry of Peter. We have Caesarea. We know there's a church there. We know there are believers in Joppa. We know historically that the apostles went to other places around the Roman Empire. And so it's not just the ministry of Paul, but we have churches being planted from nothing, from no believers, to now really all over the place. And Aquila and Priscilla tell us that the gospel had made it to Italy already. We're going to see this in a minute, but Aquila and Priscilla, as far as we can tell, they're not converted under Paul's ministry. They come to Corinth seemingly already believers. The gospel had made it to Rome. We know within a few years it absolutely is already in Rome. And by 60 AD, there is a church in Rome, a thriving church in Rome. And so we're seeing the spread of the gospel and really just the explosion of the gospel. And it's going to continue to explode. And so verse 13, the accusation of the Jews against Paul is this fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. And so their accusation, be very specific, is that Paul was convincing people to worship God in a way that was contrary to the Jewish law. That's the argument that they're making. They may have worded it ambiguously to imply it was against Roman law, but Gallio knows better. And so we're going to see for his response. They're saying Paul is teaching people to worship God in a way that is contrary to our law. Paul was about to open his mouth, but Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you. But if it is a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters. And he drove them from the judgment seat. So here we have the fulfillment of the promise of God, that he is going to protect Paul, that he's not going to allow him to suffer hurt in that city. Because now the Roman governor, which this is somewhat unusual in Paul's journeys, the Roman leaders have been very willing just to jump on board and say, well, you're obviously causing problems. There wasn't a riot before you showed up. Now there is a riot, so I'm going to throw you in jail, going to beat you, whatever it may be. And Paul's gets really the short end of the stick. And here, Gallio saying, no, this is your own religious stuff. I'm not getting involved in this. It's none of my business. So he drove them from the judgment seat. And then verse 17, now the Greeks respond in following really Gallio's example. They took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue. What was the ruler of the synagogue's name earlier? Christmas. Yeah. How did his name get changed to Sosthenes?
Must be different.
Yeah, Crispus believed and was saved. And so whether he stepped down or whether he was evicted, we don't know. It doesn't tell us. But either way, I would say his conversion led directly to his replacement as ruler of the synagogue. Because he believes he's now leading the synagogue. He's clearly going to lead the synagogue to now study Isaiah 53 and see how it points to the Messiah. And so that these unbelieving Jews aren't going to stand for it. I mean, to maybe give a modern day example, imagine you are a priest at a Russian Orthodox church. And you get saved. You believe the gospel. You stay there. Aren't you going to begin to teach the gospel? Aren't you going to begin to alter the services a little bit so that you can insert the gospel and point them to salvation by grace through faith alone? How would the lifelong, diehard members of the Russian Orthodox Church respond to a regular preaching of the gospel? Yeah, I don't know how that church is set up, but I imagine there are going to be a lot of phone calls to the head office saying, get rid of this guy, whoever his supervisor is. So they'd be calling up the regional bishop saying, get rid of this guy. They're more likely not going to stand for it. And I suspect that's what happened in Corinth. I can't say for sure that they kicked him out. He may have resigned, but I suspect that he would have been evicted from his position because of his faith. And so that he is now replaced with Sosthenes as ruler of the synagogue. So the Greeks then took Sosthenes and beat him before the judgment seat, but Gallio took no notice of these things. So you see really a radical difference in the response of the Roman rulers to the Jews and the questions and the objections that they are raising. Here, Gallio just, okay, the Greeks drag this guy in and begin to beat him, and Gallio doesn't pay any attention. It's fine, which gives you a sense of Roman justice. So, verse 18, so Paul still remained a good while, and then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. And so Paul is heading back to Syria, and he goes first to Cenchrea. Let me give you a little bit of just geographical and historical information to help make sense of Paul's travel, and also some of why Corinth is a significant city to stop and to preach the gospel in. You have the Adriatic Sea, you have the Aegean Sea. You're in a wooden sailing boat traveling the Mediterranean Sea, which, well, we know from the book of Acts, their season of the year was vicious storms. And navigation is somewhat limited. I know it doesn't look like a huge body of water, certainly much smaller than oceans, but it's a big body of water. This is a massive mass of water. And you're sailing by dead reckoning and by stellar navigation, the stars, the sun, the moon. You don't really want to get out here if you can help it. Really, they did stay closer to the shore. And just to give you an example, if you remember at the end of Paul's first missionary journey, he came down to, I believe it was Pamphylia actually, and he sailed over to Antioch. So he would have taken a ship and it would have never been real far away from land at any point. And by design. So if you are in Rome, anywhere on the western side of the Italian peninsula, and you want to go over to Turkey or over to Syria, your choice is to go all the way down and to come right through the middle of the Mediterranean, which is going to take a little while, or you can come down, you can go through the Straits or Messina, come across, come into the Gulf of Corinth, and across this little isthmus, and then keep skirting through these islands and along the shoreline. That's what they were doing. They were doing that a lot. The problem is there was a gulf and a gulf. There wasn't a body of water between them. But it was so helpful to take this trip that they actually many times would sail in to the Gulf of Corinth, dock in Corinth, unload their ships, portage everything. I think it was a mile or two across the isthmus to the Gulf in Cenchrea. And then they would take up another ship and continue their journey. It was that big a deal. It was easier to carry everything than to go around. And so this is so significant that in the 1800s, they dug this canal connecting these two gulfs there to make it easier for ships to pass through without obviously having to portage through. And so it's still used today. In fact, some of the information I found on it said it's estimated that annually about 11,000 ships use this waterway. Now, it's far too small for modern-day freighter. I don't have it here, but I saw online a picture of a cruise ship, and they're a modern-day cruise ship. And the cruise ship is as wide as this canal. The canal is only 84, 85 feet wide. So it's very narrow. And what that means, as we're talking about the city of Corinth, is this is a major thoroughfare. There's a lot of people, a lot of sailors coming in here, but not just sailors, a lot of travelers. And it makes sense of how Priscilla and Aquila would be here. They're coming out of Rome, they're traveling, they may be heading back to Turkey or maybe back up to Pontus. It doesn't tell us where they were going, but they end up here. They meet Paul and they stay for a while because they're traveling that way. So this is a hub where thousands upon thousands of people are going to be coming through on a regular basis. Now, to help us as you think through the letter to the Corinthians and some of the problems in the church there, it also was a center of Greek worship. There were at least two significant Greek temples, both of them up on a hill overlooking the city of Corinth, one to Apollo and the other to Athena. And the one to Athena was noted for its connection with prostitution. And again, as I've alluded to about the Greek and pagan worship in general, it's usually pretty immoral. And so Corinth would have been somewhat known for its connection to these immoral worship and just to prostitution in general. And so it wasn't the stellar Bible Belt city at all. So this is one of the more wicked cities in the Roman Empire that Paul spends a year and a half in. But that helps us a little bit as you think through the letter to Corinth, that they have a lot of baggage when they get saved. And in some respects, the Corinthians brought a little bit more baggage with them than maybe some others did. But roughly, that is Paul's ministry in Corinth.